Corporation against Reynolds Group Holdings. Mr. Rustowen.
Thank you, Chief Judge. Mr. Burke, may it please the Court. This is a case where we have a dispute about claim for severance benefits. There were two bases on which such a claim could have been made. One was under a merger agreement between Pactiv and RGHL. This is the claim that Mr. Rupert chose to pursue. The other claim could have been made under the Pactiv Severance Benefits Plan, which is a qualified ERISA plan. In the summary judgment proceedings, Mr. Rupert made it abundantly clear in his summary judgment filings and his response to Pactiv's statement of undisputed facts that the severance benefits plan was not the basis for his claim, repeatedly saying, it has no bearing, it is irrelevant, my claim does not arise under this. The district court ruled for Pactiv on the claims that Rupert did make. It ruled that the merger agreement did not create third-party beneficiary rights. It then, however, ruled for Rupert on the claim he disavowed and waived, saying that he was entitled under the severance benefits plan to rights. We respectfully submit that that was error, that this sua sponte ruling should be set aside, and that the record is clear that the court should, in fact, on sitting as it does in the same position as the district court on the summary judgment record, should direct entry of judgment for Pactiv. Let's start with the waiver. This court, there's actually a surprising amount of authority on this, as one discovers sometimes in doing research. My goodness, there's a lot of cases on this. This court repeatedly says these procedures that local courts have about what, you know, admitted facts and stating undisputed facts and what you say are extremely important, and we will hold parties to them.
No, that's not what we've held. We have held that district judges can hold parties to them, but not that district judges are compelled to hold parties to them. Let's suppose that the district judge here decided to relieve Rupert of any forfeiture. Now, what decision do you have that says that district judges are disabled from doing that?
We have, Your Honor, we have your court's decisions that say when a district judge decides to rule on an issue that has not been argued by the parties, and he is coming, this is where sua sponte comes from, and he is issuing judgment on something that the party against whom judgment is entered had no reason to believe was going to be a basis for the judgment, that is beyond the district court's authority. Now, could the district court have said, I think there is an issue here, I'm going to relieve Mr. Rupert of his waiver, now I would like to hear argument on this issue under the severance benefits plan? I think that would present a very interesting question, Your Honor, as to whether a party who has disavowed a claim should be resuscitated by a district court, and that would be an interesting case before this panel. I think it might well be error to do that when a party has said, that's not my claim. But he did not relieve him of that burden. He came forward with an opinion saying, I rule that Packard, you're absolutely right. He's not a third-party beneficiary. He has no rights under the merger agreement. However, I find that he has rights under the severance plan. As we also see, and this is one of the dangers of ruling on something that one party has waived and therefore the other party has not argued, the district court missed language in the actual plan itself, which is only 11 pages long, that clearly anticipated that you could lose severance benefits if you violated a non-compete or other restriction in your severance in your severance agreement.
Well, unfortunately, it doesn't say in the severance agreement.
It says in the separation agreement, Your Honor.
The language, that part of the language of the plan, sounds like a reference to people who already had no competition agreements, which, of course, Rupert didn't. Let me ask you a different question, though, about what's in the plan. Plan plainly contemplated a demand for a confidentiality promise as a condition of severance payments. Was there any dispute in the district court about whether the demand made of Rupert was one for a confidentiality agreement as opposed to a restrictive covenant?
Your Honor, you're asking me to respond as to whether there was a dispute on something that someone waived when we got to summary judgment briefing. He says, I'm not making a claim on this one. So,
I take it your answer is no.
I take it there, yes. There is no in the summary judgment record, which is what we're hearing.
I don't give a fig about the summary judgment record. This case began with a request by Pactiv for a declaratory judgment that its actions were consistent with the plan. So you would expect someplace along the line, Pactiv would have contended that its request was one for a confidentiality agreement rather than a restrictive covenant. Did Pactiv ever make such an argument?
I do not know, Your Honor.
You don't know what
I do not know what argument was.
You're not very much used to the court if you don't know what your own client has argued in this piece of litigation.
I apologize for not being of use to the court, Your Honor. I do. But in this case, I do know what my client argued.
Answer my question.
I do not know whether they made that contention because it never became in dispute. I do not know what my client may or may not have done on a number of issues that were never in dispute.
Papers filed in the district court. That's client's job. It's rule A number one of appellate advocacy. Know the record cold.
Let me ask a different question, if I could. You've made a strong case that the district judge followed the wrong procedure here in doing what he did. But we've got to worry about whether there was any prejudice as a result. Is there any evidence that you think is material to the issues that have been briefed to us that is not in front of us that you would have offered if the issues had been teed up properly?
I believe the summary judgment record establishes the evidence that the record shows.
We've got the contents of the relevant documents. We've got all the relevant documents in front of us.
Yes, including the admissions of the parties. Yes.
Okay. A couple of other factual questions, if I could. In the merger agreement, section 6.4C refers to the company's amended and restated change in control severance benefit plan for key executives. Mm-hmm. Was Rupert covered by that?
He was not, and okay. That's admitted.
Okay. And then 6.4B refers to previous plans that will continue. Company reserves the right to amend or terminate. Was Rupert covered before the merger by a severance plan? Or does it matter?
Non-union employees, and this is where we get into what there was not a written plan before mm-hmm. the merger. Okay? Mm-hmm. There was an agreement in the merger agreement, and obviously this presupposes that he's got any rights to sue under the merger agreement, mm-hmm. on which the district court ruled he did not, we believe, correctly. But under the merger agreement, you had in the section 6.4, you had, we will provide benefits, we will do so for a year, we will do so consistent with the pre-existing arrangements. Mm-hmm. The pre-existing arrangements included that for particular kinds of employees, you could make a judgment that it would include restrictive covenants. Mm-hmm. Now, in the summary judgment record, that's one of the things we say is an undisputed fact. It was attested to by an affidavit by the Director of Human Resources of the company that was the pre-existing arrangement. Mm-hmm. Mr. Rupert's response to that is, that's irrelevant. Mm-hmm. Doesn't say it's false. He says that's irrelevant because I'm relying on this subsection and not the one immediately before it, which covers the same topic.
Okay. Whether the relevant plan here is the 2010 plan that the district judge relied upon or the merger agreement itself and plaintiff's fallback position that 6.4 in essence created a short-term plan, I think we wind up still under your theory having to address the question of the non-compete. And this is what troubles me a good deal about this case. ERISA says, in essence, we've got to have a written plan so employees know their obligations and rights. We need reasonably ascertainable terms. And I've looked around for cases where I found some cases where ERISA plans include non-compete provisions, but I haven't found any in which the scope of the non-compete is left open to the employer's discretion at the time of the termination or retirement. Can you give me any guidance on that?
I think the response to that, Your Honor, is I don't think you'd find any ERISA plan, nor, and I think it would be easy, if possible, at all, to create one that categorizes for every employee who might be covered by a non-compete. This, you know, Mr. Rupert was the head of a particular consumer products division, mm-hmm. that any employee, for this employee, it's going to be this geographic scope, this period of time, cover these customers. Then you don't have an ERISA plan. You have an enormous matrix, which is why.
Right. But then how does the employee who's subject to this know what his rights are if he simply knows that at the time he retires or is terminated, the employer is going to present him with a non-compete of unknown scope?
The employer, there is nothing in a plan document itself which will tell every single employer exactly what the terms will be. We then get into a situation, which again, because it wasn't argued, didn't get, then we get into whether the plan administrator abused his or her discretion in determining what the benefits would be and what the conditions would be. And on that, this court and district courts will, you know, it's an abuse of discretion standard. We never get to that abuse of discretion here because we don't even have a claim under the severance benefits plan.
Just if, do you have an idea of what law would govern the enforceability of a non-compete imposed as part of an ERISA plan?
I think it would be federal law as to whether a plan administrator has abused his or her discretion in imposing those particular covenants. And in determining that abuse of discretion question, it is possible a court may look to state law in the area for guidance, but I think ultimately it would be a federal issue as to whether that plan, that those sets of provisions are abusive or an abuse of the administrator's discretion.
Given that non-compete law is literally all over the map, I'm trying to figure out how we would figure out what the federal common law of non-competes would be.
I think that would be interesting and difficult, and the court can be grateful that need not do so here because the issue was never raised.
Can I ask you just a couple of quick questions about the plaintiff's alternative argument about whether the merger agreement established an ERISA plan? Because that's an issue that was briefed before the district court mm-hmm. and is part of the briefing to us. In your reply brief, you said ERISA does apply to these severance benefits, and I tend to agree with that. But why doesn't the combination of 6.4C, which is the non-union promise, and 6.4D of the disclosure schedule, in essence, just create a simple little one-year ERISA plan without any provisions to amend it?
Well, we have an interesting it's that last part that I don't think is correct.
Okay.
Because what are the rules on whether you can amend an ERISA plan? Rules on whether you can amend an ERISA plan are you can't if it says you can't. The presumption otherwise is you can amend it. In this case, that ERISA plan, which we're sort of finding, you know, in a schedule to a merger agreement, that ERISA plan doesn't say you can't amend it. And this court's authorities are very clear that, you know, if it doesn't say that, it can be amended. And then the amendment would be the severance benefits plan itself, the actual ERISA plan, which there's no question was adopted before Mr. Rupert left the employ, and which could include, consistent with pre-merger practice, non-competition agreements.
I just want to be clear in terms of the standard you think the district court should have applied. Do you think, and you may have alluded to this earlier, that the arbitrary and capricious standard when deciding whether the PACTIV properly refused to pay Rupert severance under the PACTIV severance plan? Do you think that?
I think if we ever got to this issue, I find myself, if you'll forgive me, in the somewhat extraordinary position, at least it seems extraordinary to me, of arguing about what the district court should have done in dealing with something that my opponent waived. So my opponent waived it. I don't think, that's just my colleagues below who handled it at the trial level, you know, we don't think we have to say anything about it. It's out of the case. If the district court was going to do anything on what he was going to consider, his first step would have to be, I want to consider this issue, even though Mr. Rupert has waived it. He did not do so. If he had, then I think that you would ultimately get to, in a fight about the non-competition agreement, you would get into whether that was reasonable. And that reasonableness would be judged based on abuse of discretion of the plan administrator. And then we would have the interesting question of whether or not we have to develop federal common law on that. But fortunately, we do not. If the court has no further questions at the time, I reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, if that's acceptable, Your Honor. Thank you.
Certainly. Mr. Squires.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you. May it please the court, Burnham Squires on behalf of Chad Rupert. This morning, Your Honors, I would like to address 3 points, time permitting. The first is to explain why the district court was correct in its analysis. The second would be to discuss this waiver issue that the plaintiffs' appellants have raised. And with the court's permission, I will refer to them as PACTIV collectively, unless there's a reason to distinguish one of the appellants from the other. And third, with time permitting, we'll talk about the third-party beneficiary claims. Your Honors, the district court should be affirmed on its holding that Mr. Rupert is entitled to severance benefits under the severance plan, notwithstanding he did not sign the separation agreement, because the severance plan, as the court has observed, did not indicate to an employee or prospective beneficiary that signing a non-competition or non-solicitation agreement would be a conditioned precedent to receiving benefits under ERISA. Throughout the appeal, PACTIV has
Do you agree that problem is the same whether we're talking about the 2010 plan or the merger agreement as a plan, as an ERISA plan?
Yes, it's the same problem, Your Honor. PACTIV never identified that there would be a non-compete or non-solicitation provision other than what we've characterized as an oblique reference in the severance plan in the provision regarding a hypothetical breach. PACTIV has yet to identify a case where an employer has been permitted to do what it is trying to do in this case, and that is put in a non-compete agreement at the end of the day after an employee has lost his job, been promised severance, and then say, hey, here's a non-compete agreement. If you really want your severance, you cannot work in competition with your former employer. PACTIV hasn't identified a case. We haven't found a case that stands for that proposition. The district court's holding and its analysis tracks the requirement under ERISA that the court has identified that an ERISA severance plan has to include language by which an employee can review the plan and understand exactly, I think that's the term from the Supreme Court jurisprudence, exactly what their rights and obligations are. And that's under the Curtis Wright case. The district court's analysis also tracks the case from the Tenth Circuit that we've identified, Cerulis versus Unum Corp, 321 F3rd 1010, and we submit that case should certainly be persuasive, although it comes from a sister circuit, but that if it were in the Seventh Circuit, it likely would be controlling. In Cerulis, like here, we had an employee that was displaced by a corporate merger.
I think your main obstacle is the claim of waiver, and you might want to use your limited time to address that.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would be happy to. On the issue of waiver, which is linked inextricably to this phrase sua sponte ruling by the district court, there are at least 6 responses to that, Your Honor, the first of which has to do with the very nature of this claim from the get-go. I'm not the plaintiff. PACTIV filed suit in the district court seeking a declaratory judgment asking the district court to decide.
Actually, your client is the plaintiff. Your client filed a counterclaim. Both sides are plaintiffs.
Understood, Your Honor. We had to respond to the initial filing in the Northern District of Illinois.
You did not have to file a counterclaim, but you did. So both sides are plaintiffs.
And, Your Honor, both sides in both the plaintiff's claim and the defendant's counterclaim asked the court for the same declaratory relief.
Can you point to any portion of your summary judgment filings in which you affirmatively argue that Rupert was entitled to severance under the PACTIV severance plan?
No, Your Honor, I cannot.
So how can we expect litigants to make the trial court jobs easier by narrowing the issues for decision unless they have confidence that the case won't be decided on an argument that their opponent expressly said wasn't relevant to their case?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Your client said that this argument wasn't relevant to the case. The district court decided it on that basis, and so that puts the whole pretrial process, it sort of throws it out the window when a judge can go back and reach for an argument that somebody expressly rejected or said they weren't going to raise or haven't preserved.
Your Honor, I think Pactiv has kind of taken out of context the way in which Mr. Rupert said the severance plan was not relevant to his claim. He said it wasn't relevant to his third-party beneficiary claim, whether you treat the merger agreement as a contract or an ERISA plan, because Pactiv urged that the severance plan could somehow amend what had already been done. And we said, no, you can't. You didn't follow any amendment procedures either in the schedule or in the merger agreement itself, which required the approval of the board of directors to effect an amendment. And therefore, to come and say the severance plan is the new...
No, look, I could understand an argument in the district court that we're principally relying on the merger agreement, and if you don't buy our argument about the merger agreement, we want to rely on the plan itself as a fallback position. But Judge Williams just asked, did you ever make that argument? And you said no. So how can you make it here that we would love to rely on the plan as a fallback if you reject our principal argument?
Your Honor, there's two different ways in which I think that Mr. Rupert can make that argument here. First of all, as a converse principle to waiving an argument in the district court, the Court of Appeals can affirm on any basis that appears in
the
record below.
We can affirm on any basis that was properly preserved in the district court. And the argument that's been made is that this particular theory was not only not preserved, it was affirmatively abandoned.
And with all due respect, Your Honor, I disagree that it was abandoned. And the cases that Pactiv has relied on for the principle of waiver, and there's a lot of them.
All right. You've got a lot of language said to the district court that we're not relying on the plan. Where did you preserve an argument based on the plan if your argument based on the merger agreement failed?
In the counterclaim.
No, look, the counterclaim starts the lawsuit. You then go and frame the issues, right? There's an elaborate process under the rules of civil procedure for framing the issues. You don't go back to the pleadings at the summary judgment stage. And in fact, Rule 56 says, by the time we're at summary judgment, the pleadings are irrelevant. So where did you preserve the argument based on the plan by the time we get to summary judgment? That's the question.
I'm struggling with the answer, Your Honor, because I think...
Let me sharpen this in a different way, okay? You got one problem in granting summary judgment for you on a ground that you did not argue, okay? But Pactiv also moved for summary judgment based on the plan, right?
Yes.
Did you oppose that motion?
Yes.
And argue that the plan did not warrant the relief that Pactiv was asking for?
I cannot point, Your Honor, to a particular paragraph in our summary judgment resistance that said that, but collectively, absolutely, we said Pactiv is not entitled to...
There are two steps here that we're being asked to take, okay? One is set aside summary judgment in favor of Mr. Rupert, and there are procedural problems given with what the district court did there. The second step we're being asked to take is enter judgment in favor of Pactiv based on arguments made to us and to the district court. And you did oppose that in the district court, right?
Yes.
Okay.
But then I think where we may be losing the forest for the trees a little bit here is Pactiv ultimately concedes when we come to this court, it's a de novo review. So even if we come to the decision that the district court messed this up procedurally, the more efficient and appropriate approach is for the Court of Appeals to resolve the issue.
Is de novo review of those things properly preserved in the district court? An argument that's been waived is simply gone. It can't be resurrected in the Court of Appeals. It just can't be. You need to believe us about that.
I believe you, Your Honor.
And then in terms of the matter of efficiency, if we were to allow an argument to be raised that the party abandoned, it would provide, it would make it an incentive for future litigants to address every conceivable argument, even those that have been disclaimed by their opponents, in order to avoid an unfavorable decision. So we would have over-lawyering in all of these cases. I mean, the implication of what you want us to do is really, I wonder if you can see the forest for the tree. You know, I mean, because I think this is a much bigger problem than you perceive it is, but the bottom line is it wasn't preserved. If we handle it the way you want us to handle it, we're really opening a Pandora's box.
Except, Your Honor, the waiver cases and the sua sponte cases involve a party coming to the Court of Appeals who was unsuccessful below. The procedural posture here is far different. Mr. Rupert is the prevailing party, and therefore he's not asking the Court of Appeals to create an argument for him, to affirm an argument.
You're asking the Court of Appeals, so far as your argument reveals, you are asking the Court of Appeals to relieve your client of an express waiver, and we're not in that business. We're searching for a contention by you about how you preserved in the district court either an argument that you're entitled to win under the plan, or, as Judge Hamilton put it, at least an argument that Pactiv is not entitled to win under the plan. How was either of those two arguments preserved in the district court?
Your Honor, it was preserved by very nature of the declaratory judgment.
No argument in litigation is preserved by the very nature of the litigation. It's preserved by making it to the court. Pactiv says that far from making it to the court, you expressly disclaimed it. That is, you waived it. And I'm looking for a place where, in the record, you say you preserved it rather than waiving it. Referring to the very nature of litigation won't cut it.
Mr. Rupert cannot waive Pactiv's claims. When Pactiv asked the court to decide, do we have to pay
Rupert
these benefits?
Rupert can waive Rupert's claims. Rupert can stand up in court or file papers saying, I'm relying on the severance agreement. I'm relying on the merger agreement. I'm not relying on the plan. Right? That waives a claim based on the plan. Pactiv says you did that. You say you didn't. Your brief says you didn't. You're saying it. I'm asking, where in the record did you disavow that asserted waiver? It's a place. There must be some place you can point us to.
All I can do, Your Honor, is point to you throughout the summary judgment papers, the resistance, the statement, the opposition to the statement of facts. As Mr. Rupert said, the severance plan was not relevant to his claims under the merger agreement because his position was the severance benefits.
Understood. But as Judge Hamilton said, Pactiv moved for summary judgment saying we're entitled to a declaratory judgment that nothing we did violated the plan. You opposed Pactiv's motion. Where in the opposition to Pactiv's motion did you say, we are relying on the plan, we do prevail under the plan, and this is how? Did you ever do that?
Your Honor, only in the context of saying that if the merger agreement itself constitutes an ERISA plan, then the 2010-2011 severance plan did not effectively amend it because they didn't follow the amendment procedure.
So the answer is no, you never did.
Not that I can point you to, Your Honor.
Yeah, and then there's and then just in this particular case, the problem, too, with not pointing it out to the court, you know, the parties didn't brief the issue because they believed it had disappeared from the case. Pactiv never brought to the court's attention the Pactiv plan language that specifically addressed the relationship between the non-compete clause and the severance entitlement because Pactiv did not believe such an issue was relevant to the resolution of the case. So the district court didn't even have the benefit of briefing on the specific issue because everybody had abandoned it.
I would agree with the first sentence, Your Honor. The district court did not have briefing on the precise issue as the district court framed its opinion. I would disagree that there was an abandonment or waiver. I would like to briefly address Pactiv's claim that the severance plan itself does contain sufficient notice that an employee will be subject to a non-compete. Obviously, that's a different issue, and my time is running out. If we compare the severance plan, it does have language about confidentiality in it, very detailed language about confidentiality. And then the provision that PACTIV is relying upon to state that there is notice that there might be some restrictive covenants indicates to an employee if you violate the confidentiality provision, and then makes, again, what we characterize as an oblique reference to non-competition or non-solicitation agreements, then the employee will forfeit the severance benefits. But PACTIV clearly knew how to specify what the breach would be when it used the confidentiality provision in the severance plan.
By the way, why, in your view, was this requested agreement not a confidentiality agreement? It says any restrictive covenant is released as soon as the employee makes promises of confidentiality, of not using any of PACTIV's information. Why doesn't that make it a confidentiality agreement?
Your Honor, I think my time is up. May I answer?
Of course you may. As long as we're talking, you can answer.
The separation agreement that was presented to Mr. Rupert included a pure non-compete that said he could not.
And it also said, and that agreement, that limitation goes away as soon as Rupert promises not to use the confidential information. It's essentially an enforcement clause for a confidentiality agreement.
I haven't looked at the issue that way. I know Mr. Rupert viewed it as being a prohibition on him competing.
This too was never argued in the district court. Thank you, Mr. Squires. Anything further, Mr. Rusthoven? I would say you've got about 24 seconds.
Well, in my 24 seconds, first I would invite the court to look at the appropriate pages which are identified in the record about the admissions. I think you will find that the waivers are not qualified with respect to anything. It's just this is irrelevant. I would like to read the court the second paragraph of the return of servants benefits provision.
It is not necessary to read out clauses. We have them in the papers.
It is my belief that when you read that paragraph, you will see that it refers not simply to confidentiality agreements, but also...
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is taken under advisement.